WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Junk bonds. Well, they weren't junk to Michael Milken. He made a fortune on them. And he used junk bonds to finance major corporate takeovers. In fact, he's one of the people most responsible for fueling the takeover mania of the 80s. Junk bonds are cheap and risky because they're offered by companies that are seen as financially unstable. But Milken calculated that with good research, he could invest in bonds whose rewards would far outweigh the risks. And he was right. While most people on Wall Street thought of junk bonds as junk, Milken's investments were transforming the company he worked for into one of Wall Street's most powerful investment banking companies. That company, now called Drexel Burnham Lambert, is currently under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The investigation is related to the insider trading scandal. My guest, journalist Connie Bruck, has written a new book about Milken and the corporate raiders he financed. It's titled The Predator's Ball. Bruck is a senior reporter for the American Lawyer magazine. She's also been published in The Atlantic magazine, Manhattan Inc., and The Washington Post. She began researching her book well before the insider trading scandal broke on Wall Street. She was able to interview many of the key players before the SEC investigations got their defenses up.
I started it in 1985 when Drexel was a phenomenal success story and there was no hint of the government investigation that was to come.
So you think if the Ivan Boesky bust had happened, if the Wall Street collapse had already happened, if the investigations into Drexel Burnham had started happening, that the people who you got to interview wouldn't have spoken to you?
I think that they either wouldn't have spoken to me or would have spoken to me in a really guarded way. I did have access to some people at Drexel, or actually quite many people at Drexel, even after Ivan Boesky's plea agreement and the start of the government investigation of Drexel. But that was only because I had already been at the firm for about a year, and so I was, you know, as they realized, most of the way through my project. But even so, and even though I knew these people by this time very well, they became much more guarded with me than they had been before that.
You explain in your book that you started very sympathetic to Michael Milken, who you write about, to the Drexel firm, and that you saw them as the kind of underdog in the world of high finance?
I definitely did. I mean, it was sort of an underdog firm with underdog clients. I call them in the book, and I think of them, their clients particularly, as the have-nots of the corporate world. And they were challenging the establishment. And just personally, I always find that attractive.
Now, your mind changed. We'll find out how a little bit later in the interview. Let's talk about what a junk bond is so that we'll understand the basics here. Give us a really simple explanation of what a junk bond is.
Well, a junk bond is a bond which is perceived by the financial marketplace as being high risk, and because it is perceived as high risk, it pays a high interest rate to compensate the investor for the risk that they're supposed to be taking.
Okay, now your book is in part about Michael Milken, who's considered the king of the junk bonds. If this is considered such a high risk, why did he think that there was more to junk bonds than people had given credit for?
Well, Milken, one of Milken's favorite themes, which he talks about when he gives speeches, which he does infrequently, but he does sometimes do, is perception versus reality. Milken has believed for many years that he sees what others do not, and that the financial world, that there are basically misperceptions about risk, and that many companies which are small or which don't have credit histories and are therefore rated non-investment grade by the rating agencies, he believes that they are not risky, and that that therefore investing in their bonds, which pay a high interest rate, is a good investment.
Yeah, and he thought that if he did the research and had faith that this firm would make it, that he had a pretty sure bet, whereas if he played the stock market, it was so dependent on what other people thought.
Well, exactly.
That he couldn't be sure at all. So he felt pretty secure with these junk bonds by comparison.
That's exactly right. And Milken has just immense confidence. First of all, he works harder than anyone I've ever met. So his research was incredibly thorough, and he has immense confidence in his own rightness.
I love the name Junk Bond. It might as well be called Garbage Bond. How did it get a nickname like that?
I don't know how it really did. Meshulam Ricklis, who is one of Milken's great admirers and clients, claims that Milken coined the phrase himself in a conversation with Ricklis back in 1970 or so, where Milken was talking to Ricklis about the bonds of Ricklis's conglomerate, Rapid American, and Milken reportedly said, "Rick, these bonds are junk." And Ricklis responded whatever and said, "Well, yes, but they pay a good interest rate, they pay," and so forth. So Ricklis claims that that was the beginning and that Milken's been trying to get rid of that term ever since. I don't know whether that was really the origin or not.
What do you think he'd prefer to call it?
Drexel has for years really fought, struggled to have people call them high-yield bonds. It's only actually in the last year or so, since Drexel has many other worries, that they have sort of relented and referred to them themselves as junk bonds.
Journalist Connie Bruck is my guest, author of the new book, The Predator's Ball, The Junk Bond Raiders, and The Man Who Staked Them. Okay, so we have Michael Milken deciding these junk bonds aren't a bad thing at all. You can make a lot of money with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so first he starts making money investing in these junk bonds himself.
Right.
Then he figures he can make even more money by getting a lot of clients who will invest in the junk bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And now, how would he make money if he gets other people to invest in them?
Well, if he gets other people to invest, basically he was creating a market. In the beginning, when he was buying them, he would buy them for himself, for some wealthy clients. They'd buy them, since they were deep discount bonds, they'd buy them at something like 10 or 20 cents on the dollar. And if Milken was right in his research, then the price of the bonds would go up. So that maybe they'd go up to the full dollar. They always made money. But what he wanted to do was to create a whole market where there were issuers that were issuing the junk bonds and a whole ranks of investors to buy them, and then there would just be more money to be made for everyone. And that's, by the late 70s, what he succeeded in doing.
Now, one of his tools for getting more people to buy into the junk bonds was a big annual party that he'd throw that was nicknamed the Predator's Ball. What was the real name?
The real name was Drexel's Annual High-Yield Bond Conference. It was actually called that real name for years. It started back in the late 70s. It was not until 85 that it achieved its nickname of the Predator's Ball, because it wasn't until 85 that the most honored guests there were predators, or predators meaning really corporate raiders.
Okay. At the Predator's Ball, which is to attract new investors into the junk bonds and then to use that money in takeover bids. At these Predator's Balls, there were a lot of lures to attract new clients. Give us a sense of what the big attractions were to get people to come.
Basically, there were many attractions. I mean, one thing was that there was a terrific sense about Milken. It was sort of an evangelical event. By the mid-80s, certainly, by 84, 85, Milken was convinced that he was out to change the corporate world, which indeed he was doing. And so many people came because they were just excited to feel part of this whole thing. It was almost like an evangelical meeting. And then beyond that, there were, for the 100 or so high rollers, there were each year the special events. There were dinners at Chasen's, which is this very sort of posh restaurant in Beverly Hills. There were parties later at Bungalow 8. There were really attractive young women whom I was told were paid by Drexel to come. And one Drexel client said they were paid according to how pretty they were and what they would do.
There's some big name entertainment.
There were big name entertainment, right? There was Diana Ross, Frank Sinatra. So there were lots of reasons to come, and also a lot of business got done at these. There were just deals being made right and left for loads of people there.
What's the connection between the junk bonds and the corporate takeovers, the takeover mania of the 1980s? How are the junk bonds used to finance corporate takeovers?
The junk bonds are what have made it possible for the takeovers to be as enormous as they have become. Only junk bonds, basically, in any one of these takeovers, the way they're used is that the bonds are sold to investors and the cash that is produced from those sales is then paid to the shareholders of the company that's being taken over. So, in other words, you wouldn't have to, if you wanted to take over a company and it was a $4 billion company, and if you were a small company, there's no way that a bank would loan you that kind of money. But since Milken could raise billions of dollars from the sale of junk bonds literally overnight, it meant that anyone, no matter how sort of small, could take over any other company, no matter how large.
Yeah, so you had very unusual things happening. Give us an example of a pretty small company that was able to take over a really large company because of financing from junk bonds.
Well, Nelson Peltz is one of my favorite examples. He had a controlling interest in a small company, Triangle Industries, which was a wire and cable company. Its revenues were something like $290 million. And it took over National Can, which had, just for so you frame of reference, had revenues of $1.9 billion. That's a good example of sort of the comparative sizes. And Nelson Peltz would never have been able to do that transaction if he didn't have Milken there to raise the financing.
So this junk bond financing was really knocking the whole balance of power out of whack.
Well, it certainly was challenging the established rules. I mean, what I say in the book is that it was as though the whole game was sort of turned upside down, because the powerful, the strong and powerful, could be threatened by anyone. So in a sense, the weak became the strong and the strong became the weak. Or at least the strong became the threatened. Until Milken, the strong could only be threatened by someone basically of sort of equivalent size. And after Milken, this was no longer true.
When Milken was at his peak, and you say this was around in 1985, how is he regarded on Wall Street?
I would say actually his peak I would put in 1986, because 1985, Wall Street was still fighting him. There was the Revlon battle. Wall Street was still hoping to sort of stamp out this upstart. By 1986, he had really reached his peak, and he was not only really accepted by Wall Street, but he was imitated by it. There were articles in the business press comparing him to J.P. Morgan, and the rest of Wall Street, which had previously really despised Drexel and despised junk bonds, was now trying to get into the business.
Okay, let's get to the turnaround where things start to slide. You say, first of all, that junk bonds started to become junkier. You want to explain?
Well, as the enthusiasm for this kind of paper grew in the market, and there were buyers just everywhere for nearly any junk bond that could be issued, the quality of the bonds began to deteriorate, which means that the companies that would be issuing them would have less good credit. Basically, the point is that there was such enthusiasm, there was such belief that any deal would work, especially if it was Milken's deal, but such belief that any deal would work, that investors would buy pretty much anything.
And then, too, there were people who were pushing for protective legislation to prevent unfriendly takeovers.
There were people doing that, but basically none of those bills went anywhere. Drexel, not only because of this, but certainly part of it was that Drexel lobbied very effectively against that legislation.
One of the turning points in this story is the arrest of Ivan Boesky, his arrest for insider trading, for alleged insider trading at the time. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I guess the people on Wall Street call it Boesky Day. What's the date specifically of Boesky Day?
The date was, I guess it was November 14th, if I'm not wrong.
Of 86.
And that was the day that Boesky, that his plea agreement with the government was announced, where he pled guilty to insider trading and was given the largest fine ever levied, which was $100 million.
What's his connection to the story that you're telling about junk bonds financing corporate takeovers?
Well, Boesky was an arbitrageur, and arbitrageurs are people who bet, when a takeover is announced, they bet on the idea that the takeover is going to go through. They buy up the stock the day it's announced. If the stock is is trading at $50, and if the takeover is going to go through at maybe $60, they buy it at $50 on the hopes that it's going to go through, and they'll make $10 on each share. That's what an arbitrageur is. That's what Boesky is. And so he was a very important player in the whole takeover game because he accumulated enormous stock positions.
Okay, well, I want to get to more connections in the story, and we'll also talk about the effects of the stock market crash and the current investigation, the current SEC investigation into Drexel Burnham, the company that Michael Milken still works for. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is journalist Connie Brook. She's the author of the new book, The Predator's Ball, which is about junk bonds and takeover mania. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Connie Brook is my guest, author of The Predator's Ball, The Junk Bond Raiders, and The Man Who Staked Them. Well, Connie, we were just talking about Ivan Boesky and his connection to this story. Now, Drexel Burnham, the firm that Michael Milken has worked for years, is now under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And this is related to the Ivan Boesky affair. What's the connection?
Well, when Boesky pled guilty, part of his plea was that he would cooperate with the government. And he, we now know, has given the government loads of information which implicates Milken. Remains to be seen whether what Boesky has said is enough to cause Milken to be indicted, and more than that, enough to cause Milken to be convicted by a jury. But in any event, that is what Boesky did.
Do we know how he's implicated in the story?
How Milken is implicated? Mm-hmm. Well, there are basically there are reports in the press. It's pretty complicated to say. I mean, basically, we know that Boesky has claimed that Milken has manipulated the markets in a variety of ways.
Okay. Let's look at the stock market crash of just a few months ago. Did that do anything to change the growth of junk bonds?
Well, for a while, for about a month or so, it seemed that it might have been. See, basically, the world is divided into two camps. There are the people who think that junk bonds are. I'm oversimplifying, but you can say this. The world is divided into two camps. There are the people who think that junk bonds are great, and there are the people who keep saying, well, yes, we know that nothing bad has happened so far, and we know that everybody is making money hand over foot. But as soon as there is a recession, you are going to see that the whole junk bond empire is going to come unraveled. Basically, these companies that have issued the junk bonds are going to go into default. And there will just be, it'll go like a house of cards. These are the two camps. Well, after the stock market crash, many people believed that a recession was about to come, and that if that recession came, exactly this, that all these companies would go into default and the junk bond empire would come undone. Junk bonds did plunge in price at the time, not plunge, but they went down sort of sharply in price after the stock market crash, but then they rebounded. So many people who were sort of writing the obituaries for the whole junk bond market had to eat their words because within several months, they basically came back as strong as ever.
So there's still a big market for junk bonds.
There still is a big, thriving market for junk bonds. Of course, the recession never came, obviously. So the people who say, well, come the recession, you will see junk bonds go, are still saying that, and they have not yet been proven wrong.
Are they still being used to finance corporate takeovers to the same extent that they were a couple of years ago?
Certainly not to the same extent. And Drexel is not as active in that market as they were then. But basically, Drexel is under this cloud. I mean, we can't, until the cloud of the government investigation is removed, Drexel will not be able to operate freely.
If there have been fewer of these unfriendly takeovers in the past couple of years, to what can we attribute that?
Well, I guess I would say that there were fewer in the... Well, that's not true.
Okay.
What there have been hostile takeovers, but they're more the way they used to be, which is of major companies by major companies.
As opposed to small companies buying bigger ones.
That's right. Because as opposed to Drexel's kinds of clients, what I call them, the have-nots of the corporate world, instead the transactions that have existed have been more enormous companies buying other enormous companies and financed, you know, with bank debt, not as much using junk bonds.
Connie, let's get back to something that you said at the very beginning of our interview. You said when you started off to report on this story, you really saw the the main characters in this book, the people who were investing in the junk bonds, as being the underdogs. Mm-hmm. And you were pretty sympathetic mm-hmm. to it and wanted to see how the underdogs were challenging the big guys mm-hmm. on Wall Street. Now, you walked away with a very different impression than the one you started out with. How did it change?
Well, at the beginning, it didn't change, you know, 360 degrees. I basically thought at the beginning that Milken and his people were making so much money that it was possible that there had to be some sort of underside to this. And I guess what happened in the course of my reporting, which was about 2.5 years, is that I became convinced that there was a substantial underside, what looked to me like, you know, substantial illegality. And I just felt that it was a world that was dominated by one man, Milken, who was a genius, but who had no, I think that he's, my view of him is that he's someone who is a law unto himself and sort of feels he's beyond the law.
Now, you were able to interview Michael Milken for your book.
Mm-hmm.
How much time were you able to speak with him?
Well, I saw him twice in the whole course. I saw him at the beginning, and that was a brief meeting. And then I saw him at the very end, and that was for somewhere between 3 and 4 hours.
If the press reports are true about this, he offered to pay you for the amount of books you would have expected to sell had the book been published and sold, to tempt you to not finish writing the book.
Well, actually, the press reports are true, and what happened was that was the first meeting, which I mentioned, the brief meeting.
Well, explain to me what happened.
Milken was giving a speech to a group of security analysts in Boston, and one of them invited me to come. It wasn't open to the public, but he knew that I was just setting out then to write this book. It was February of 86. So he invited me to come, and after Milken's speech, I went up to him, and I told him who I was and what I was doing. And he said, "Oh, I've heard about your project. You know, I don't want it to be done." And I said, "Well, I'm doing it." And he said, "Well, why don't," and that's when he said, "Why don't we pay you the money that your publisher would have paid you, except we'll pay it to you to not write the book."
What did you tell him?
I said, "That was fine, but what would I do for integrity for the rest of my life?"
And what did he say?
Well, actually, it was a two-part thing. He said, "Why don't we pay you the commitment fee that your publisher will pay you, except we'll pay it to you to not write the book." And then I said, "Well, what will I do for integrity?" And then he said, "Or why don't we pay you for all the books that you would have sold if you had written it?" So I guess what he thought was that he just had not offered a big enough price the first time.
How did you decide whether or not to mention this to anyone and whether you should include it in your book or just tell it to the press?
Well, I just, at the time, I was sort of taken aback by it, but from what I was already hearing about Mike Milken, it didn't surprise me that much. So I sort of told it as a great anecdote to a couple of my friends, and I always thought that it would be part of my portrait of him in the book somewhere. I didn't know how it would come in, where it would be, but I always thought that it was certainly an interesting insight into the man. And then when I wrote the book, there was a place that seemed right for it. Basically, that leaked out. The way it got into the press was it leaked out before the book was published. I don't know who did that, but that's how it got into the press. So it wasn't that I went to the press with it.
Connie Brook is the author of The Predator's Ball, The Junk Bond Raiders, and The Man Who Staked Them. So you came away thinking that there was more underhanded stuff than you had initially expected to find in the story.
That's right. I did.
Can I ask you how, this is a big question, but how you think Wall Street has been changed by the story that you write about in your book, the story of the junk bonds and the financing of the unfriendly corporate takeovers?
Well, I think there really has been an immense restructuring, and that Milken, while he is not responsible for all of it, has done more to shape it than any other one individual. First of all, there were the people that he backed who took over other companies, but more than that, he caused other companies who were fearful of being taken over to adapt some of the sort of methods themselves, to restructure themselves and to get leaner and trim down and cut costs. They did that for fear that they would be taken over if they were seen as too fat targets. And then there was the whole wave of leveraged buyouts, which he also he didn't originate that, but he contributed to it and made it much larger. Basically, the whole move to the owner-manager, as opposed to companies, you know, public companies being run by management, now They're very often, many cases, run by people who either have been taken private and so are owned totally, or are run by people who have a 20 or 30% stake in them. All these things Michael Milken was not the sole originator of, but the person more than anyone else who is responsible for them.
Well, you had a few hours to talk with him. Did he strike you as a very charismatic man? Could you see in those few hours that you spent with him what it was about him that enabled him to start this new trend on Wall Street and attract a lot of clients and a lot of followers to his way of thinking?
I didn't really see it. He's very intense, and you can certainly see that. People refer to him as charismatic. I did not perceive him that way, but, you know, I was only with him for a few hours, and I do know that certainly the people who have worked for him, you know, see him as, I say in my book, they see him as larger than life. Someone who used to be part of Milken's group said that, you know, if Milken had walked over a cliff, everyone in that group would have followed him. And someone else in his group said, you know, someone like Mike comes along once every 500 years. So although to me, although I didn't see it myself, I know that people are in awe of him.
Do you think that there's a moral to this story?
Well, I guess there's one thing that I was often thinking when I was writing. I thought of something Warren Buffett said, which is that he said you can get in much more trouble with a good idea than with a bad one. And I guess that's what I really think about Mike Milken. I think he had a you know, a great idea, and I think he got into a lot of trouble with it.
One last question. Are you an investor yourself?
No, never have. Don't own one stock.
And would this encourage you or discourage you from investing in the future, the research you've done?
I don't know. I just never think, I never have thought of applying it to my own life.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your research. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
My guest has been journalist Connie Brook. Her new book about junk bonds and hostile corporate takeovers is titled The Predator's Ball. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.